Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, do we teach civics anymore? Technically, yes. In the public school systems of all 50 states, we often call it government. But are these courses fulfilling the spirit of our country's founding when it comes to civic responsibility? Thomas Jefferson had something like this in mind. Quote, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. Earlier this year, an article in the magazine of the National Education Association addressed that spirit and responsibility this way. Quote, one of the primary reasons our nation's founders envisioned a vast public education system was to prepare youth to be active participants in our system of self-government. The responsibilities of each citizen were assumed to go far beyond casting a vote. Protecting the common good would require developing students' critical thinking and debate skills, along with strong civic virtues, unquote. The article concludes that we are experiencing a crisis in civics education. Only 25% of U.S. students reach the proficient standard in civics assessments. Civics is defined as, quote, the study of the rights and duties of citizens, unquote. The people behind Seattle's Civic Saturday program don't exactly teach civics, but they are attempting to revive interest in the rights and duties of our citizenship, and their program is expanding to new cities around the country. They talk about their mission here. Eric Liu and Janae Kane led this last Civic Saturday gathering at Washington Hall on October 1st. Their next gathering is Saturday, November 18th at the Elliott Bay Book Company. Thanks to Sonia Harris for this recording.
Thank you for being here after we took a short summer hiatus. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome. If you are an old friend, welcome. To Civic Saturday on Sunday. We're so happy to be here. First of all, I would like to start by saying Citizen University would like to acknowledge that we are on Indigenous land, the traditional territories of the Coast Salish people. So, here we go. I'm Janae Kane. I am the co-founder of Citizen University. Thanks for being here.
And I'm Eric Liu, co-founder of Citizen University. And actually, for how many of you is this the first time at a wonderful, wonderful. So as you may have a sense of, Civic Saturdays began right after the election, a periodic gathering that our organization, Citizen University, started convening to be something of a civic analog to church or synagogue or mosque. It's not, of course, any of those things, but it is about American civic religion, about the creed that we've inherited as people living on this land and in this polity right now, and trying to reckon with the meaning of that creed, the spirit of it, and the ways in which we are called as members of the community now to try to live up to it during these extraordinary times. We are having our first Civic Sunday or Civic Saturday on Sunday. I'm not sure which I like better. And we wanted to acknowledge that we moved our date because of the observance yesterday of Yom Kippur. And so those who are here today, who observed this Day of Atonement yesterday, we wish to say, may you be sealed in the Book of Life. And for those of us who didn't observe the day yesterday, may we nonetheless, in atonement, be sealed in the Book of Life. So, well, thank you.
So for the next hour, as we sing together, listen to poetry, share civic scripture, and get to know one another, I ask you, let's be present together. We love social media posts and spreading the word, but let's do that after. So first off, I'm very excited to introduce a young woman who I met in middle school. When I directed her as the valiant Wesley in The Princess Bride at Tufts. Now she is a senior at Garfield, and she is Seattle's Youth Poet Laureate. Lillian, yeah.
Say her name.
Yeah, Please welcome Lily Ann Baumgart.
Thank you. Hi, guys. Thank you for having me here. I feel very honored. I think that protest is something that's very important, but I also feel very conflicted about the culture that's like, I go to one protest and I'm clean. Look at what a great citizen I am. And I think it's more important to like keep doing it actively throughout your lives. So the three poems I'm going to read are kind of more about, or I guess directed to people who go to like one big protest a year and are like, done my job, check that off, because it's not just checking it off, you actively have to live it. Confession. Have you unsexed yourself, taken God into your full mouth and swallowed him whole like he was your enemy? Have you forgiven your mother for your name? I cannot wait for you to grow old, for your bones to hollow themselves out, leaving birds to nest inside your knees. Take solace in the wooden bench your ass is sat on, and look forward into the darkened door. Have you found your mother in no place? Have you turned your cheek to kiss mine? Place this cross on your chest and breathe in like your lungs are full of holy water. This one's called, I Have an Innocent Love for Her. We Are Not Grown Up. I am challenged by vulgarity and its ugliness. I find myself avoiding its messiness. If I can keep myself a clean slate, I am only others to dirty. I need to find a mud puddle and lay in it. This is how I will say sorry to myself. When I find this puddle, I can lay in it for hours. I can see my body slowly sinking into the earth. Perhaps it will swallow me. I think it'd be nice to be able to bury myself. I will need to do it without a coffin. It needs to be messy and dirty. I want to lie down clean and new and feel the mud creep underneath my fingernails. One more, you guys can make it through. This one's not so much, it's more about how I felt after the election about going out to protest versus how I would act within like my own life and interactions with the world. And it's called Unbelievable. My tongue didn't fit comfortably in my mouth anymore. It was like I had no more words left to say, so I cut my own voice box out. I dissected it to try and find any lost sentences. I should have picked at my brain and placed my thoughts on my lips instead. It would have been less work. All of my words are true, and it still feels like chewing rocks to feel them leave my mouth. I think that if I could see my reflection in the eyes of a police officer, the words might come easier. And if not, perhaps I would feel I had purpose. Thank you.
We are now going to hear three readings followed by a sermon from Eric. And so for these readings, we'll hear first from Lorette Hanna, and then Sonia Lay, and finally Charles Jackson.
My name is Lorette Hanna, and today I'll be reading Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. from the Three Dimensions of a Complete Life sermon at the Friendship Baptist Church, Pasadena, California, February 28, 1960. And so, there are three dimensions of any complete life to which we can fitly give the words of our text: length, breadth, and height. Now the length of life, as we shall use it here, is not its duration, not how long it lasts, not how long you live, but it is the push of a life forward to achieve its inner powers and ambitions. It is the inward concern for one's own welfare. The breadth of life is its outreach, the outward concern for the welfare of others. And the height of life is the upward reach for God. If life is to be complete, these three must be together. In other words, life at its best is something of a triangle. At one angle stands the individual person. At the other stands the other persons. And at the tip top stands the supreme infinite person, God. If your life is to be complete, all three must work harmoniously together and properly be cultivated. For the complete life is a three-dimensional life. Is your faith in organized religion? Not totally. Yes, my faith is in the church, within that church, that spiritual church. But sometimes I get worried about our particular churches. We are busy warring amongst ourselves, caught up in narrow sectarianism, giving out sanction to the status quo. Slavery could not have survived in America if the church hadn't sanctioned it. Segregation would be dead as a doornail in the South today if the Southern white church took a stand against it. So today I say to you that my ultimate faith is not in organized religion, but I have a faith. What is that faith? I say to you this morning that my faith is in the eternal God whose purpose changes not. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Sonia, and today I'll be reading Henry David Thoreau from his lecture, Civil Disobedience, first delivered in Concord, Massachusetts, 1848. I meet this American government, or its representatives, the state government, directly and face to face, once a year, no more, in the person of its tax gatherer. This is the only mode in which a man situated as I am necessarily meets it, and it then says distinctly, recognize me. And the simplest, most effectual, and in the present posture of affairs, the indispensablest mode of treating with it on this head, of expressing your little satisfaction with and love for it, is to deny it then. I know this well, that if 1,000, if 100, if 10 men who I could name, if 10 honest men only, if one man in the state of Massachusetts ceasing to hold slaves were actually to withdraw from this co-partnership, to be locked up in the county jail, therefore, it would be the abolition of slavery in America. For it matters not how small the beginning may seem to be. What is once done well is done forever. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Charles, and I will read Annie Dillard from A Writer in the World, included in her essay collection, The Abundance, published in 2016. One of the few things I know about writing is this: spend it all, shoot it, play it, lose it all, right away, every time. Don't hoard what seems good for a later place in the book or for another book. Give it all, give it now. The very impulse to save something good for a better place later is the signal to spend it now. Something more will arise for later, something better. These things fill from behind, from beneath, like well water. Similarly, the impulse to keep to yourself what you've learned is not only shameful, it is destructive. Anything you do not give freely and abundantly becomes lost to you. You open your safe and find ashes. After Michelangelo died, someone found in his studio a piece of paper on which he had written a note to his apprentice in the handwriting of his old age. Draw, Antonio, draw. Antonio, draw and do not waste time.
Wow, those are some good readers. Good morning. It is so great to be back after our summer hiatus, and so great to be with all of you. Yes. And I think it's rather fitting, actually, that we should be meeting on a Sunday, actually, on the day and at the time when many others are watching the NFL. Because on any given Sunday, as they say in pro football, anything can happen, especially when the President of the United States is on Twitter. Yeah. Now, what I hope happens today is that we'll make a little sense out of all the nonsense and take a little bit of hope out of the raw, cynical hypocrisy of our times. I'd like to reflect on three simple ideas this afternoon. Three dimensions of this three-dimensional life that Dr. King spoke of. Gratitude, luck, and risk. Let's start with gratitude. My friend C. Terry Warner is an 80-something retired professor of philosophy at Brigham Young University. Some of you have heard me talk about him before and talk about his classic book, Bonds That Make Us Free. Its core insight is that at every scale of relationship, we fall into a cycle of collusion in which I accuse you to excuse me. When in my heart I know I've done something wrong, I avoid blame for it by casting blame on you for something else. You then return the favor. And Warner's book explains so much, not only about human dynamics, it explains so much about our politics today. It explains almost all of Twitter, actually, if you just follow the ways that people accuse to excuse and counter-accuse to counter-excuse. Its core prescription, Terry's book, is that the only way to break this cycle is, in fact, to break it, to set in motion a counter-cycle of responsibility taking rather than responsibility shirking. Well, earlier this year, I decided, after quoting Terry Warner seemingly every other day, that I actually should reach out to the guy. And so I did. I emailed him, and I told him how much his work and his life have shaped mine, and I asked if we could have a phone call. And so we did. And it was really nice. It was great. His hearing wasn't so great, and I had to speak slowly and keep things seemingly simple, and yet there was a great connection. And then I sent him my new book on citizen power, and he read the book almost immediately, and then he sent me a letter about it. Later this summer, Janae and I, by the way, for those of you who don't know, Janae is both the co-founder of Citizen University and the co-founder of my marriage. And the latter is far more important. But this summer, Janae and I were in Utah to visit a couple of national parks, Arches National Park and Canyonlands National Park. And so we arranged to meet Terry and his wife, Susan, at their home in Provo, Utah. So picture the scene here. A devout Mormon couple, married for several decades, with 10 kids and 50-plus grandkids. He, a former teacher and mentor of Mitt Romney, sat down with an irreligious Seattle couple, married 3 years now, each with a daughter from a prior marriage. I, a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton. We got on famously. We ate cookies and ice cream that Susan had made, and we talked about art, acting, phenomenology, philosophy, political philosophy, German and French intellectual history, missions and legacies, both secular and spiritual. We were there for just 90 minutes, but that face-to-face visit opened up something for which I am profoundly grateful. It has made Terry and me much more frequent correspondents. It has also made us mutual mentors. And what a gift it is to learn from someone who is an elder. And what a greater gift it is to be told by that elder that he is learning from you. That is priceless. So our friendship has gotten me thinking lately about the nature of gifts and the meaning of gratitude. Gifts, properly understood, are not transactions. They are an exchange, a perpetual exchange, if you're lucky. In this sense, power itself is a gift. Every form of power we have as citizens, our voice, our presence, our ideas, our wealth, our beliefs, our creativity, our vote, exists not so that it can sit idle and inert, but so that it can be circulated, exchanged, given, not thrown away heedlessly, and then returned gratefully. In a healthy community, the circulation and exchange of power generates gratitude all around. In a healthy society, people remember that we're all better off when we're all better off. We have to give to get and get to give. But in a sick society, it's not that way. In fact, one clear symptom of sickness is a corruption of the language and the spirit of gift exchange and gratitude. Let's go back for a minute to the NFL and black athletes taking a knee during the anthem. One of the most striking things about the media firestorm that followed Trump's tweets last weekend was how many white so-called conservatives on cable shows and talk radio brought up the topic of gratitude. They did so in a peculiar way. What they said was, in effect, these millionaire athletes, instead of grandstanding, they should be grateful that they get to play a game for a living. They should be grateful to the country that lets them do that and lets them be rich. Now, this idea that black people shouldn't protest racial injustice or dissent in the public arena because they're just lucky to be here, and for some of them to be millionaires, is, in a word, un-American. It is as un-American as a US president getting elected with the help of Russian disinformation. More than that, it is a weaponization of gratitude itself. It's a case of the entitled and privileged expecting, not getting, and then eventually demanding tribute from those whom they think they've done a favor. Colin Kaepernick may indeed feel blessed to live in the United States and to do what he is doing to push the United States closer to its stated creed of justice for all. But he owes no expression of gratitude to anyone but those who have taken a knee with him. When gratitude is expected, it is no longer a gift. It is a tax. This spirit of smug, oblivious entitlement animates the Trump proposal now to cut income and estate and corporate taxes for the very wealthy. It's odd that white heirs to vast fortunes aren't subjected to lectures on Fox News about how grateful they should be just to be here. And how perhaps they might express that gratitude by being willing to pay just a little bit more in taxes. Instead, we get from the trickle-down crowd this line: I'm a job creator. You're lucky just to be in my presence. Don't make demands of me. Don't ask me what I will do for others. Just thank me. Send me your tribute, your tax breaks, your bundled dollars. Well, I have no such gratitude to offer. Maybe the GOP will win this round of our tax debate. Maybe they will apply their tools and sources of power effectively enough to enact unnecessary tax cuts for the very wealthy. But they will not be able to compel me to be thankful for it. I will feel lucky, though. Lucky that I'm in a society where I can mobilize countervailing power, people power, to remedy the damage wrought by selfish, self-dealing plutocrats. So now let's consider the second topic of luck. The white privileged and the trickle-downers have a strange blindness when it comes to luck. Then again, we all do. In our profoundly unequal society, with meritocratic gold star collectors like so many people here today, this society conditions us to believe that what we have is what we earned. That individual hard work and virtue, or the lack thereof, explains our place in the world. That's a bunch of crap. Let me take inventory for you. Let me take an inventory of my luck. I had the dumb luck to be born here in the latter third of the 20th century and to grow up in a time of incredible peace and prosperity. I had the dumb luck of parents who, while immigrants, had social capital and education. I had the dumb luck that when my father became unlucky and was diagnosed in 1977 with end-stage kidney disease, he lived in the land of Medicare and therefore could get equipment and training for home dialysis. He lived another 14 years, and we were not bankrupted by those years. I had the dumb luck of being in an IBM family, in an IBM company town, when IBM was at its very peak. Summer jobs for the children of employees, college scholarships as well, health and dental insurance, pensions, a death benefit. Yes, I worked hard. I work hard. I work my ass off, actually. I work hard enough to get into a college that then compounded my good fortune by opening the entire world to me, opening up a world of unending dumb luck and connections. But countless others work just as hard who didn't have the deck stacked in their favor this way. Some are teenagers in Tukwila today, or single moms in Ohio, or old men in Yemen, talented but not connected. Talented, but unlucky. I'm talented, but stupidly lucky. I'd be an idiot if I didn't admit that, or if I were to resent you for pointing it out. And by that measure, among others, we are governed today by idiots. During the so-called debate last week over the so-called plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, one Trump aide said to the media that he was offended that healthy people should have to subsidize sick people they didn't know. Think about that for a moment. In other words, he was offended by the very moral and operational principle of insurance. The great thing was that this set off a cascade of commentary on social media in which everyday Americans began their tweets and their posts, quote, "I was a healthy person subsidizing sick people until," fill in the blank, "until I broke my leg, until my husband got diagnosed with cancer, until my son was in a car accident, until, in short, bad luck struck." My dad used to love the old 1930s comedian W.C. Fields. He loved to quote a piece of dialogue from a W.C. Fields movie called My Little Chickadee. It's about a con man. And in this film, there's a piece of dialogue that goes like this. A newcomer comes in. He says, is this a game of chance? And the con man looks at him and says, "Not the way I play it." My dad quoted that all the time. And we laugh at that now, but the truth is, that's the way it actually feels to many of our fellow Americans today. Not the way I play it. Luck seems in short supply to the many. Education and health insurance are more costly and contingent if you can get them at all. The line between holding on and falling apart is thin and ever shifting. There are no IBMs anymore, not in the sense of a social contract and a safety net that way. And you don't get a fair chance just by having the dumb luck to be an American. The game of social and economic opportunity today, from tax breaks to college admissions, is rigged to favor those who already have opportunity. So when I take inventory of my luck, am I agreeing with those righteous dog-whistling Fox News commentators who tell us that Kaepernick and LeBron James should just shut up and count their blessings? No, not at all. In fact, the reason why I detest those dog whistlers is that they do not see their own luck. They do not count their own blessings, their own unearned parcels of power, as subpar white men hired by a TV network to make subpar white men feel great again. They only want, in their scolding of NFL players who take a knee, they want to pretend to be the source of other people's luck. They know nothing of true gratitude. In his book, Success and Luck, the economist Robert Frank describes a variety of social psychology studies that show that the more self-aware you are about how chance and randomness have shaped your successes and opportunities, the more likely you are to find lasting happiness and purpose in life. And the more likely you are as well to support and promote the common good, even at some personal cost. Which brings me to the final topic today, which is risk. We heard during the readings a piece of Thoreau's Civil Disobedience. He wrote this speech in 1848, some of you may know, after having spent a night in jail in Concord, Mass, for refusing to pay a poll tax. He had refused to pay because he believed that to pay was to support a national government that tolerated and sustained slavery, and that had just gone to war in Mexico to build an empire. He could not abide complicity in such sins. Now, the Civil War was still 13 years away, but the impending crisis of disunion was visible to anyone who cared to look. Thoreau looked unflinchingly. He was fussy, self-righteous, cranky, inconvenient, a little misanthropic, but he was definitely woke. And I want to share another passage in his talk about the push for abolitionism and reform in the 1840s. Quote, "Practically speaking, the opponents to reform in Massachusetts are not 100,000 politicians at the South, but 100,000 merchants and farmers here who are more interested in commerce and agriculture than they are in humanity and are not prepared to do justice to the slave and to Mexico, cost what it may." cost what it may. Those are four big words. Let them sink in for a minute and ask yourself, what are you willing to spend for justice? What are you willing to risk? Perhaps it's true that the United States today doesn't face as foundational a moral evil as slavery, but we do, of course, face a living legacy of white supremacy. And I'm talking about the white supremacists who don't carry torches, those who perpetuate the positioning of whiteness as the social default in medicine, in law, in education, in art, in philanthropy, in healthcare, in media. You may, if you are white, agree that the unearned and compounding advantages of being called white should eventually be wound down and dismantled. But imagine that eventually is now. What are you willing to give up? A promotion? An internship for your kid? A low marginal tax rate? The dividends from the family wealth that began to accrue and accumulate with your grandfather's GI Bill? A personal comfort level on the bus or on your street? But maybe what are you willing to give up is the wrong question, or only half the question. The other half is this: what can you imagine gaining? How can you imagine advancing by yielding? Because a system of white supremacy that must unrelentingly dehumanize non-whites also unrelentingly dehumanizes whites. You have nothing but that emptiness to lose. You have your entire humanity to gain. The ending of whiteness as the default setting in America is not zero sum. It is a positive sum proposition. Cast your whole vote, Thoreau wrote. Not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence. So let me ask you, what is your whole vote? What is your whole influence? Is it your art? Is it your friendships? It is perhaps your privilege, your comfort, your assumptions, your reputations, your connections. Cast that vote for economic and social justice, cost what it may. Real justice, we know, is not cheap. We can argue about the pros and cons of Kaepernick's choice to kneel when he kneels, but we cannot argue the fact that he has paid a price for his choice. He has been willing to risk his reputation, his wealth, his prospects for employment. True gratitude costs something. Saying thank you for your service to one of the million people who've done 16 years of war fighting for us is gratitude on the cheap. So is letting them board the plane first or applauding them during the seventh inning stretch. True gratitude means calling for a draft or demanding higher taxes to pay for the, quote, war on terror, or pushing, as Republican Senator Rand Paul did 2 weeks ago in a very lonely gesture on the Senate floor, for an end to the open-ended authorization of military force enacted after 9/11. For an actual debate, for an actual debate about what we're willing to spend in blood, treasure, and legitimacy for an endless war against an uneradicable tactic. If you've been watching the engrossing, heartbreaking Ken Burns and Lynn Novick documentary on PBS, The Vietnam War, you realize how the absence of such a reckoning can be corrosive to a country. In that era, both the young people who answered the call to fight and those who organized protests against the war were willing to take great risks to uphold their ideas of true patriotism. So what are we willing to risk? The reason I believe in progressive taxation is not because I love taxes, but it's because I believe in a higher principle of progressive contribution of your time and your talent. The more you have, the greater a share you should share. But unlike the tax man, I do not wish to compel you. I invite you. And I want to let you in on a little secret. To pay your share is not a burden. It is a liberation. And this is one of the many things I've learned from my friend C. Terry Warner. Now, I was not raised in a church or in any faith tradition. C. Terry Warner and I have never spoken about his faith and his eldership in the Mormon church, except for this. When we were having ice cream and cookies, he and Susan described at length the missions that they still go on in their 80s all over the world, serving and building and circulating their power and their know-how and relationships to benefit others. Not as charity, mind you, but as responsibility. Not as a duty, but as a right. As a form of freedom, properly understood. And Terry has pressed me since then to examine my own work in the world more closely, more intensely. He has done this so that he might press himself to do the same. So let us today make three commitments together so that we can all navigate the game of chance we call life. First, to exchange gratitude like a gift. Second, to circulate our good luck rather than hoard it. And third, to take a risk with your own capital so that it may help another prosper. These are the acts of grown men and women. These are the choices citizens make. These are the bonds that make us free. Thank you very much.
I want you to reflect a little bit on this question on what are you willing to risk or spend for justice? And then later, and I'll explain this a little later on, we will form civic circles so that those of you who can stay can go deeper and discuss this with one another. We have some fabulous people here today that I know are very, very good at facilitating or just holding space for conversation, and I hope they can stick around and help with that.
As we close here, I want to bring to the podium and introduce to you, we have a new, brand new chief operating officer at Citizen University, and her name is Tara Beach, and I want to invite Tara to come on up here. Talk about luck. We are so lucky to have Tara, who many of you may know in the community for having served for many years as district director here for former Congressman Jim McDermott. And we're just so excited, Tara, that you're on board. So
thank you. Thank you. Deborah, put that down. thank you so much, Eric. This is my first Civic Saturday. I've been on the team for 3 months, and I've been sitting here kind of smirking because I did grow up going to church, and I've been thinking about what this would look like, and it's beautiful. In my upbringing, after a great sermon and a great service, we would say, and the church said amen. So the civic church says amen or mazel or snap or whatever. So let's give one more round of gratitude to Eric's service. Thank you. So just really briefly, you know, having worked for a member of Congress for 18 years, such a progressive, wonderful member of Congress, and coming to Citizen University, it's been amazing because as we have seen what's happening in this nation right now and in this world, things seem really, really heavy. And I feel myself feeling really, really sad sometimes. But when you see this and you see how rooted in community Civic Saturday is, it's really exciting, and it gives us hope, and it gives us joy. And I think it's because of the support that the Seattle community has shown this program that, if you haven't known yet, Civic Saturday is going national. So we will be traveling to 10 cities in 2018, working with community, working with communities that are underrepresented or uninvited, really key at making sure the people who are in the room need to be in the room. We're not going to end Seattle Civic Saturdays. We have two more coming up, and we'll do more next year, but the ones for this year are November 18th at Elliott Bay Book Company and December 16th, to be determined. So if you guys have any ideas, let us know. Along with the National Civic Saturday program, there's also a civic seminary. So people can take what Eric has done and replicate that in their communities and continue to heal this nation. So I'm off to Atlanta this evening for this program. And so it's been great to join you this morning. Thank you, Eric.
Wow, I couldn't tell. Most people hate public speaking. I love it. Not everyone does, because they never know what I'm going to say. Okay, I'm sticking to the script. Okay, thank you, Tara. Okay, that is all I have to say, except to say thank you, thank you, thank you. It is great to be back together. We really appreciate the community coming out. Come on.
It's great to be back. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for tuning into this extra episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Tune in again soon.